Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, our election 2024 coverage continues. This morning, we hear from Congressman Mark Molinaro, incumbent representative for New York's 19th district. It's one of the most competitive congressional districts in the nation and could determine the majority in the U.S. House again. Science Stories with Joe Johnson. Our resident science guy is here with some science stories that sparked his curiosity, including a ring around the Earth, fruit fly brain mapping, and scuba diving lizards. Yes. And the Spanish Alps, Las Filas, a popular Catskills destination for Spanish and Cuban vacationers in the 60s and 70s. Patricio Rubio has a preview of a new documentary as part of Hispanic Heritage Month. That's all coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Hezbollah militants in Lebanon fired a ballistic missile into central Israel today and say they were aiming for the headquarters of Israel's spy agency. The Israeli military says it's the first time this has happened and the missile was intercepted. Israel has been launching hundreds of deadly airstrikes in Lebanon. Meanwhile, China says it launched an intercontinental ballistic missile into the Pacific Ocean today. That's heightening concerns among China's regional neighbors and competitors. As NPR's Emily Fang says, it's also raising anxiety over China's nuclear weapons buildup.
China did not say where the missile landed or what route it took. The ICBM was carrying a dummy warhead, but it is designed to carry a nuclear payload. It's the most public test yet of China's nuclear weapons program. A Pentagon report last year estimated China has about 500 nuclear warheads, which is less than a third of what Russia and the U.S. possess. But China is building hundreds of nuclear silos and is aiming to double its nuclear warhead stockpile by 2030.
NPR's Emily Fang reporting. People are evacuating from areas along the Gulf Coast of Florida. Tropical storm Helene is churning that way. The system is expected to develop into a major hurricane before coming ashore tomorrow in the Big Bend area of Florida. From member station WUSF, Carrie Sheridan reports preparations are underway.
Sandbag operations are busier than normal in Sarasota, where many homes far from the coast flooded just a month and a half ago. That was because of Hurricane Debbie, which passed here as a tropical storm. County worker Joe Perkins says people are taking Helene seriously.
A lot of people are scared what's going to happen, especially with everybody gotten flooded out with Debbie. So a lot of people are worried.
Police are urging people to evacuate if asked and stay out of rising floodwaters. Many public schools are closed as their buildings are converted to emergency shelters. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Sheridan in Sarasota.
Vice President Harris will be campaigning in Pennsylvania today, a key swing state in the November election. NPR's Alejandra Marquez-Hansa reports Harris is expected to talk about the U.S. economy and manufacturing at an event in Pittsburgh.
Harris is going to a city known for its steel industry to describe her manufacturing policy for the first time. That's an area of the economy that President Biden focused on. She will describe her approach as pragmatic, according to a campaign official granted anonymity to talk about the speech before it's finalized. And she will promise to work with the private sector. This comes after former President Donald Trump promised to cut taxes and regulations and offered federal land to manufacturers. With early voting starting, the campaigns are trying to reach undecided voters in key states with their economic messaging. Alejandra Marquez-Hansa, NPR News.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 80 points. The Nasdaq is up more than 50. This is NPR. Later today, the House of Representatives is set to vote on a government funding bill. The stopgap measure would fund the federal government through December 20th after the election. Speaker Mike Johnson needs Democrats to pass this legislation. Many fellow Republicans have held it up, demanding a measure to ban non-citizens from voting. That is already illegal. The state of Missouri executed a man last evening who prosecutors had come to believe did not commit the crime. From St. Louis Public Radio, Rachel Lippman reports on the case of Marcellus Williams.
Officials at the prison south of St. Louis pronounced Williams dead shortly after 6 p.m. local time. His final statement gave praise to God. Williams always maintained he had nothing to do with the 1998 killing of a former newspaper reporter at our home in a St. Louis suburb. Earlier this year, St. Louis County Prosecutor Wesley Bell launched an unsuccessful attempt to have the murder conviction and death sentence thrown out. Bell said in a statement that the execution did not serve the interest of justice. The Midwest Innocence Project called it a, quote, grotesque exercise of state power. Missouri's Republican governor, Mike Parson, called it finality to a case that had languished for decades. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lipman in St. Louis.
A black combat medic from World War II has been posthumously given the Army's second highest award, the Distinguished Service Cross. Waverly Woodson Jr. was part of the D-Day invasion. He treated 200 Allied troops while under heavy German fire, even though he was also wounded. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lisa, a mattress brand who believes good sleep should come naturally. Lisa donates mattresses to nonprofits across the U.S. to improve their communities. Learn more at leesa.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill, and we are continuing our election coverage here with extended interviews with local candidates. New York's 19th congressional district stretches from Tompkins County in the west all the way to Columbia County east of the Hudson. It's a massive swath of the Empire State that includes parts of the Catskills, Hudson Valley, Southern Tier, and Finger Lakes regions. Incumbent Congressman Molinaro, Mark Molinaro, who has a background in public service as a former mayor of Tivoli at age 19 and later as Dutchess County executive, faces a rematch in the 2024 election against Democrat Josh Riley, a Harvard-educated attorney and former congressional aide. Their 2022 contest was tightly fought, with Molinaro securing a narrow victory. It was one of four seats Republicans flipped in New York on their way to winning a narrow U.S. House majority. Now we meet again Representative Molinaro, the Republican who has represented New York's 19th congressional district for the last 2 years. Congressman Molinaro recently spoke with Patricia Rubio on local issues, setting the stage for yet another closely watched race.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, let me tell you, it's been a real honor and privilege to represent this part of New York in Congress. You mentioned, you know, I've spent every day of my adult life working and living in New York, upstate New York, and trying, by the way, to get government to actually support and respect the people it serves. We live in, and I am thrilled and honored to represent a part of the state that knows, you know, what it's like to see families leave because of high cost of living, businesses leave, employers leave. Sadly, the burdens of property taxes. I pay my property taxes. I got to pay sky high Central Hudson bills. So I'm, we're raising our four kids in Catskill and trying to make sure that, we get into soccer practice, and you'll find me at the Hannaford or the Sam's Club, like everyone else, just trying to ensure that our community is a place that respects and appreciates the people that live here. And quite frankly, it's what I've done in Congress, trying to make this federal government respect upstate New York. Over the course of the last 4 years, we've shouldered the highest burden of inflation. I mean, massive federal spending. When the Democrats controlled both the House, Senate, and the White House, you know, they authorized $5 trillion of your money to be spent in lots of different ways. Some of it really critically important. I support, for instance, the CHIPS and Science Act, want to invest in infrastructure. But in other ways, that spending drove up costs, significantly drove up costs. And we're all shouldering the burden of that. Everything is more expensive, and our dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. And families and farmers and small businesses are pinched because of it. I know it, and I live it. Additionally, though, what we saw when President Biden took office is they adopted my opponent, D.C., Washington, D.C. lawyer Josh Riley's border playbook. He sued in the Supreme Court 23 times on the side of dismantling border security. And because of it, we saw this administration allow 8.5 million individuals into this country. And it does have an impact. It has an impact on services. It's not fair to communities to be overwhelmed in that way. We've seen, obviously, the crisis in New York City because of sanctuary city policies in New York. We've shouldered a large amount of cost for individuals who, quite frankly, should have to go through the appropriate asylum process before entering the country. But that has put such a burden and really has created such a crisis that here we are 4 years later. you know, having to contend with it. And so for me, you know, I've spent the last year and a half listening to and learning from the people I represent, Republican and Democrat. I'm the second most bipartisan member of Congress, the fifth most productive member of the House and Senate, because I work with anybody, Republican or Democrat, when it comes to trying to solve the problems that face America and face the communities I serve. What is important now, you know, is that our communities and our families are respected, that we work to drive down cost, we ensure that we're securing the border, and that ultimately we're providing for public safety.
If you could continue a little bit more on that, what would you say are the most pressing issues facing the 19th Congressional District today?
Yeah, I think cost of living, we start with cost of living. Listen, you know, as I say, I pay high prices to Central Hudson. I'm a customer. I know energy costs have gone up, both because of American energy policy, outsourcing and buying, you know, products from countries that don't like us very much, to the regulations that New York State has consistently allowed these rates to continue to rise. Cost of groceries. You know, as I said, I have four kids. We're buying the same big boxes of of cereal and getting less, inside the box. You know, the family size bag of chips doesn't feel like it's a family size bag of chips anymore, but you're paying twice as much. So it's cost of living. And when you add that on top of, the rate of inflation and the inflationary, you know, the highest rate of inflation in 40 years forced on us by reckless spending, when you add all of that on top of the high property taxes that New York State forces down onto New York 19 residents, we shoulder the highest burden of taxation and among the highest combined costs of any communities in the country. And what that demands is somebody who understands that you got to be responsible with people's dollars. You have to drive down taxes for middle-class families, which is why I supported the bipartisan tax relief package we adopted this year in the House, which would provide meaningful middle-class tax relief and expand the child tax credit to provide real relief for families. So cost of living remains number one. You know, can you pay your way? Can you at the dining room table, you're worried about groceries, you're worried about making ends meet, driving down costs is a priority. Public safety is as well. And that's linked to border security. And so we have a scenario where, this administration, again, my opponent, 23 times before the United States Supreme Court arguing, to dismantle border security. 20 years, a lawyer down in Washington, D.C. He worked for Senator Al Franken on a mass amnesty bill, worked to surrender the southern border. And because of it, we see crime in communities rising and burden on communities. And that has affected New York 19 in two really meaningful ways. You see not only the New York City taking your taxpayer dollars to house individuals who should have gone through an asylum process before they were put up at the Roosevelt Hotel in New York City, but also New York City transporting them upstate. It's why I joined with the Congressman Pat Ryan, Democrat, in calling on President Biden to declare a state of emergency to reestablish the protections that were in place when he took office and to end the sanctuary policies that New York City was engaged in, which resulted in your tax money transporting people to upstate New York. And so you have that sort of challenge on us, which has caused real burden, real concern. But then we wake up 3 weeks ago to a Peruvian gang leader committed 23 murders in Peru, escaped prison in Peru, came to the southern border, was arrested. Thanks to the policy that Josh Riley argued for in court, prosecutorial discretion, this administration chose not to keep that individual arrested and instead released him and then transported him, ultimately ending up in Endicott, New York, in the southern tier of this district. 23 murders. He's living with his girlfriend, who was engaged in a lot of his crimes, living freely in Endicott, New York. We shouldn't have to worry about that. Public safety as it relates to border security and public safety as it relates to the policies that came out of New York. Cashless bail has made us less safe and has tied the hands of law enforcement. I have a long history of working in local government on prevention and intervention and really trying to help people who we can intervene with early get back on their feet. Cashless bail makes it impossible for law enforcement to provide for community safety and ultimately hurts both victims and the community as a whole. We need a voice who's going to stand up against that. We need somebody who's going to push back against those kind of policies. So I work with law enforcement, support law enforcement, and work with our communities to invest in the tools necessary to prevent incidents of crime. The last thing I'll just tell you is I obviously live in and have for my entire life upstate New York, just creating opportunity, making sure that we have a focus on driving down the cost of housing. So we need obviously to drive up housing stock, right? Build more house, restore and revitalize homes in communities, villages, and cities across upstate New York, and attract new employers by working together, Republicans, Democrats. It's why we launched Broom's Next Chapter, an effort to get to business leaders and community leaders working together to establish a concerted economic development effort. It's why on the Agriculture Committee, I fought damn hard for upstate farmers so that we could create new drive down regulation and open up new markets for New York's farmers and make it more affordable to grow the agricultural industry. And it's why I'm very passionate about supporting those with substance use and mental health issues and those with disabilities. Because if we can provide help to people, meet them where they are and help them to get to where they need to be, we'll be bringing new folks into the workplace. We'll be able, there'll be more individuals who are able to sustain themselves and create their own definition of success. And so for me, there's little question that driving down costs, securing our border, and creating opportunity for the people I serve by listening to and learning from them remain the priorities.
And it was one of the questions I had was housing affordability. You just mentioned concern across New York State, and you mentioned some things you have done. I know in your time in office, what have you been doing so far to help the housing crisis that we are facing in the New York Congressional 19th District?
So not only was I instrumental in ensuring low-income housing tax credits and housing development credits were built into appropriations bills that we adopted bipartisan. I led a bipartisan effort to ensure that those programs remained funded and that we were able to expand them. We also included and fought for low-income and disability housing credits in the tax package, bipartisan tax bill that we adopted this year in the House. But beyond that, been working on the Ag Committee to ensure that USDA continues to fund through community development block grants and home loans the ability to build new housing stock. And so I've always felt like, as a member of Congress, you have two roles, right? You have to advocate in Washington for those kind of things that I just mentioned, right? We've got to drive down the cost of development. We've got to make it easier for those middle class and lower income and those with disabilities to access the credits necessary to make the purchase or to rent the homes. But then your other job is to be in the district working with the local leaders to create the environment for, in this case, for new housing development. And so I work hand in hand with cities, towns, and villages to help them rewrite their zoning code if they have them, streamline their master planning process, engage in early environmental reviews to make it easier to attract development and to move the revitalization of existing homes. We've got beautiful villages and city center, and we know that there are buildings that need to be, can't be restored. Well, towns, villages, and cities needs the support to make that happen. I do that hand in hand with local community leaders, housing organizations, in the municipalities. We also, over the course of the last year, have directed some $27 million in federal aid. These are your dollars, taxpayers sent into Washington. I have fought to bring them back. And we've directed $27 million last year. We'll direct another $35 million this year, to invest in infrastructure, water, sewer, streets, and sidewalks, because those are costs that are prohibitive for housing development. And so for me, having been a county executive and a mayor, having actually lived here, when IBM left and the employers started to turn away, my stepdad was one of the first to lose his job. We know what it's like to have them leave us. I mean, hell, my opponent left New York 20 years ago. God bless him. Made millions of dollars in Washington, D.C. But for us, living in upstate New York, what we've seen is the costs go up and some of the opportunities go down. And so we are able to reverse that by working towns, villages, and cities, state, federal government, getting that all working together to grow more housing opportunities, right? We need more development and every rung of the housing ladder from transition to low cost and low income housing to middle-class family and workforce housing, even to luxury housing. You need every rung of that ladder effectively having enough supply so that as people want to move up or down in the community or into the community, there's housing available to them. And the only way that happens is to get the federal government working with the state government, working with local governments. And I'm the only person running this race who knows how to do it because I've been doing it. And that's, for me, a principle, folks. You got to drive down housing costs by making more housing available and ensuring that people who struggle the most have access to the resources to make the purchase.
And another issue that's just facing the 19th Congressional District, especially I was talking, say, here for Sullivan County, the environment is a key issue for many voters. What are your policies, or have you done, or any policies to protect and improve environmental quality in the 19th District?
Yeah, I'm a conservationist by heart. I grew up in the Hudson River Valley in upstate New York. I led the fight to clean the Hudson River, holding polluters accountable. By the way, bringing Republicans and Democrats together to hold the line and force the EPA to demand complete and total cleanup of the Hudson River. That is the same policy I hold for the other waterways and tributaries and aquifers that exist throughout the district. And so I have not only led on bipartisan efforts to ensure funding for the preservation, protection, and access to the Delaware River, Shenango, and ensuring that we have the ability and the dollars necessary to protect those waterways and those watersheds. I also have worked with local environmental groups to ensure that the municipalities have the tools to protect our natural environment. For me also, through my work on the Agriculture Committee, very dedicated to conservation measures within the Farm Bill, expanding those conservation measures. And what that means is giving tools to farmers and others preserve soil, to maximize irrigation, to drive down wasted water resources. I lead a bipartisan effort to confront climate change and climate resiliency as it relates to flooding from Sullivan County to Delaware to Broome County and all points in between. We have massive flooding concerns. And so I have bipartisan legislation that would provide the tools and dollars necessary to do the mapping and to invest in the resiliency necessary to preserve, to ensure and prevent flooding damage. And I serve on the bipartisan conservative climate caucus, where we have advocated for continued tax credits for alternate energy development. And have supported, by the way, even in this case, this administration's efforts to ensure that alternate energy manufacturers like the solar and the wind turbine developers that exist in Broome and in Tompkins County have the resources and the tax credits necessary to build out those manufacturing opportunities, those jobs, and of course, the technology here in America.
Right. Congressman, we're wrapping up here a little bit. You answered a lot of the questions I had already. I had questions about both.
I try to do that. I think when you ask a question, you should answer, which is why it's so fascinating to me that I've agreed to I think, do 6 debates around the district, which I love doing. And my opponent, I think, has agreed to do 1. I'm not sure why. I just think you go out before the people, you answer the questions, be held accountable, yeah, and then encourage people to vote.
So in my last 2 questions here, since this is an election year for the president, are you supporting Donald Trump to be the next president and why?
I am. I think at the end of the day, I want an administration that understands we have to secure the border and drive down costs. And let me just tell you, and this is, this is what's troubling to me overall. I mean, I'm running against a person who 2 years ago celebrated dismantling border security, celebrated massive increases in federal spending. He ran an entire race that was entirely linked to and 100% supportive of the policies that the Biden administration has engaged in. I'll work with anybody. So like I said, I support the CHIPS and Science Act, support infrastructure investment, and worked with the administration on mental health programming. But there have been some egregious examples of bad policy choices my opponent has embraced. Now, all of a sudden, millions of dollars behind him from all over the country paying for TV ads. He suddenly is trying to convince people that he's all for border security. I just don't like this concept that you attempt to rewrite who you are in order to buy yourself a congressional seat. And so for me, I encourage people, you vote for who you think is going to serve this country best. In the 19th congressional district, I will always call balls and strikes, whether it's Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. I will speak out on behalf of the people I serve. It's why I'm the second most bipartisan member of Congress. It's why I will work with Republicans and Democrats from Aileen Guthrie in Sullivan County and Senator Schumer, where we worked to get the high intensity drug trafficking designation for Sullivan, to Michelle Hinchey and Chris Tagg in Greene County, trying to ensure that we're making smart investments in agriculture. Don Lopardo out in Broome County. I'll work with anybody who's honest and earnest about solving the problems that face the people of upstate New York. And the decision we have before us for Congress ultimately is, do you want someone who is going to be your voice, right? For the last 20 years, I've worked with Democrats, but also held Democrats accountable. I've worked with Republicans, will also hold Republicans accountable, because I think it's so really, I think we are desperately in need of alternative voices in upstate New York and in the state, fighting back against single party rule, pushing back against policies that don't make sense, and ultimately bringing people together to mold the consensus necessary to drive down cost, drive down housing costs, make our communities more affordable, make our communities safer, and ensure that there's opportunity for people who work and struggle the hardest, those living with mental health concerns, those living with disabilities.
Why should voters vote for you over your opponent?
Well, listen, I spent every day of my adult life working and living in upstate New York. For the last 20 years, my opponent's worked more in Washington than I have, and frankly, has tried to rewrite his own personal history here. He supported dismantling border security. He supported mass amnesty, and the result has been 8.5 million people enter this country. He supported massive federal spending that resulted not only in waste, fraud, and abuse, and we know it, but the highest rate of inflation and shouldering the highest cost. I've been working these last 2 years to kind of reset, right? Voted for border security, received the endorsement of law enforcement in our communities, the endorsement of Border Patrol, because I know how important it is to provide for public safety. It's the fundamental responsibility of government. We cannot overlook the safety of our neighbors, friends, and families. And I've been working consistently locally and in Congress to drive down costs, both provide meaningful tax relief and make smart investments so that we can drive down costs. Everything from daycare to infrastructure. I want to be sure that we're making our communities more affordable and there's more opportunity for the people who live here. And I'll speak for people who don't often get to have their voices heard. It's why I've truly have worked across every aisle to ensure that we're reaching out to those with mental health and substance use disorder, working in Sullivan County to bring a treatment center, working in Broome County to drive dollars to bring recovery and treatment center dollar programming to Broome County. It's why I care and speak out so passionately for those with intellectual, physical, and developmental disabilities. You know, everybody, regardless of ability, deserves opportunity. And the bipartisan legislation that I sponsored and our Think Differently initiative nationwide, working with lawmakers and foundations, is breaking down barriers and creating opportunities for those with disabilities. Everything from making it easier to access special education to jobs and transportation for adults with disabilities. And so I'm just somebody who, like I said, I'll work with anybody to get the job done and solve the problems that face the people we represent. I care about this community. I live in it. I pay my taxes in it. I buy my groceries in it. And I want us to be respected, and I want our community to be more affordable, and I want to ensure that we are safe, secure at the border, provide for safety in our communities. My opponent doesn't get to rewrite his past. He was an advocate for dismantling border security, an advocate for driving up cost. And frankly, we've seen that playbook all before. We live in a beautiful part of the state. I mean, this is by far among the most beautiful parts of New York, with resilient people who care deeply about making a difference. I've been one of them for the last 48 years, working hard as an adult to try to make this community better and to make government work for the people it serves.
Congressman, thank you so much for joining me on the program. We've spoken to Congressman Mark Marlano, the congressman for the 19th district, running against Democrat Josh Riley in the 2024 election. Thank you so much for joining me on the program, and good luck this November.
Thanks. Be well.
And all right. Great. Thank you so much.
And tonight on the Local Edition, we talk to Representative Molinaro's challenger, Josh Riley. And on Friday, we'll bring you the Catskills News and Mid-Hudson News Decision 2024 debate for the New York State 100th Assembly District. Paula Kay and Lou Ingracia Jr. debate the issues together in the same room. That's Friday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season. Quick break for us, and we're back with science stories from Joe Johnson.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjayville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Radio Catskill and StoryCorps invite you to have a conversation with One Small Step, bringing people with different political beliefs together to simply talk about their lives. Apply today at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. What's scaly, striped, and breathes underwater like a scuba diver? Water annals. They're semi-aquatic lizards found in the tropical forests of southern Costa Rica. Joe Johnson is our resident science guy, a retired Port Jervis science teacher and Radio Catskill volunteer, and that's one of the stories that caught his eye this week. The others include fruit fly brain mapping and a ring around the earth. Let's start with the fruit flies.
Well, this was in the September 11th issue of Nature magazine. This is a group from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Then what they're doing is they're investigating the wiring of a fruit fly brain, specifically the visual system. Now, if you took biology, you probably worked with fruit flies. Drosophila melanogaster is the species. Really highly studied organism, genetics, experiments, all kinds of stuff. But it has a brain with only about 100,000 neurons. For comparison, you and I have about 86 billion neurons. So it has this tiny, I mean, think how small a fruit fly is, mm-hmm. and then think how small its brain must be. The thing is, that brain has been very accurately mapped using microscopy. And so we know how many neurons there are and what they're connected to. And so
what's microscopy?
Microscopy, using a microscope.
Okay.
Sorry.
You have to break it down for me, Joe.
Okay. Well, when you think about it, fruit fly with only 100,000 neurons, these critters can fly, they can avoid predators, they can navigate, they can walk around, they can find a mate. In other words, this 100,000 neurons is a very efficient little brain. Okay. So what they did was they looked at specifically the optical lobe of the brain, the part that processes optical information from the compound eyes of the fruit fly. And this has about, that part of the brain has about 46,000 neurons, but about 1.5 million connections between them, which may sound like a lot, but it's really, really not. It's what they call sparse connectivity, and it actually increases the efficiency. There's 64 different kinds of neurons. So what they did was they built a computer model of this part of the brain, okay? And they connected it to a deep learning AI model, and they showed it, this is the weird part, a set of animated short films that are used to test computer visual algorithms. And they actually watched it learn. They watched it learn how to predict how something was going to move. And they found that, they said it's very similar to the way a baby learns. And it really got very accurate at predicting and kind of figuring out what was going on in these videos. And they then compared the videos, showed the videos to real fruit flies, and they got the same reaction.
Do we know what movies they showed them?
This little set of animated clips, they described them as water flowing, smoke moving. They said there were some action sequences. I don't know what that means. Anyway, the model works perfectly. And this has a lot of implications because some of the human visual system works the same way. And so if we can understand that, we can start to understand more about our own brain.
So they can use this to help model more complex brains, yes, like ours.
Yes. This is the first step, I think. I think they're going to be modeling more than this.
Well, we all have more respect for the fruit fly then.
Absolutely. Now, here's the important part to me. AI systems are nowhere near as efficient as this brain, as this Drosophila melanogaster fruit fly brain. And so if they can learn something from the architecture of it, if they can learn something from how it works and then apply that to AI systems, you would make those systems a lot more efficient. AI systems are huge power hogs. I read that they're going to try and start up Three Mile Island to power Microsoft's AI. And so, yeah, that's crazy. So if we can make it more efficient, we'd use a lot less electricity in these things.
Throwing me a curveball there.
Yeah.
Speaking of curveballs, Saturn is the only planet that I know of that has a ring around it. But apparently Earth had a ring at one point.
Yeah, this is an idea that's been around for a while, but a group finally got together and published on it. This was in the Earth and Planetary Science Letters in September. They think that Earth had a ring around it about 466 million years ago. And by the way, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune all have rings. It's just that Saturn has the big, you know, very evident rings, but Jupiter, Uranus, and Neptune have much fainter rings. The story goes like this. They think that an asteroid came too close to the Earth and basically was torn apart by the Earth's gravity. It came inside with something what's called the Roche limit, okay? And the debris, this broken up asteroid, these chunks went into orbit around the Earth and formed a ring around the Earth. This is very similar. I don't know if you saw the mini moon story.
Yeah, with the asteroid that's kind of coming in and going into orbit.
Well, it's actually not going to go into orbit. It's going to kind of get curved around us, but I don't believe it's actually going to go into orbit. This is also really similar to how we think the moon formed. We think that, you know, about 100 million years after the Earth formed, we got hit by something about the size of Mars, and the debris went into orbit around us and formed the moon. So there's, that theory kind of is similar to this. But the ring theory, the whole idea here, explains a geological mystery that I'll get to. I'm going to give you a little allusion to that. So the evidence, you know, if you got this claim, you've got to prove it. So what does the evidence look like? Okay, so about 40 million years ago, during the Middle Ordovician, there was a period of enhanced impacts on the Earth. There was a lot of meteorite impacts on the Earth, and they were all the same type of meteorite. It's called an L chondrite. It's a low iron, very stony meteorite. Okay, this is called the late Ordovician meteor impact spike. Okay, so piece of evidence number one.
Now, during that period, the Ordovician period, was there life on the planet?
There was, but most of it was in the seas. There was very little land life during this time period. This was right after the Cambrian explosion, is the Ordovician. And so most of the life was in the seas, and it was the early Ordovician was a very warm time. Okay, so there were a lot of very tropical seas. There was it was a pretty warm planet. So we've got this 40 million year period of impacts. We've got 21, they've identified 21 impact craters that are up to 50 kilometers in diameter that all happened within this 40 million year period. These are big impacts, and they're all within about 30 degrees of what was then the equator, not the equator now. Okay, because you remember from Earth science how the continents are in motion. Okay, actually the northeast was very close to being on the equator. Where we are right now was on the equator then. And so there's all these impacts, really big impacts, right over the equator. Also, L chondrite dust is seen in sedimentary rocks from all over the planet, okay, during this same time period. Now, there's a mystery that's been going on that this may actually solve, and that's called the Middle Ordovician extinction event. This was the first of Earth's, everybody's heard of mass extinctions. Mm-hmm. Well, there's been about five of them. Some people say there's one going on right now. But this was the first of the mass extinction events, and it was a glaciation event. The Earth cooled down, the seas got a lot shallower because ice got locked up around the poles, and about 85% of all those tropical ocean creatures went extinct during this time period. And what they think is that the ring was dense enough to shade the tropics, was shading the equator, and that's where we get the most heat from the sun. And so that may have led to this giant cooling event, and that's why all these things went extinct.
And this is a new perspective on how this all happened.
Right,
it requires some more study, I'm assuming.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But this, it kind of ties together a lot of, different pieces of information, a lot of pieces of evidence here, and it kind of ties it neatly together. I'm going to be following this story.
And moving on to the next.
This is the cutest story of the day.
Scuba diving lizards.
Yes, this was from the Biology Letters of the Royal Society. And it's a unique adaptation of a species of water anole, which is the semi-aquatic lizard species, Anolis aquaticus, that lives in the tropical rainforests of southwest Costa Rica. It's brown and green striped, cute little guy, about 6 or 7 inches long, really well camouflaged. But it has this special adaptation that allows it to breathe underwater. now comes about as a result of a defense mechanism. This is the, these guys have been described as the chicken nuggets of the forest because everybody wants to chomp them. They are prey for a lot of species. And what they do is they hang around the water and they dive underwater to, you know, get away from their predators.
Yeah.
But the scientists studying them noticed that they could stay underwater for up to 20 minutes. And, you know, they have lungs like you and I can't stay underwater for nearly 20 minutes. And so they started studying them. And what they found was this, that this little lizard, when it gets underwater, will exhale a bubble of air, which sticks to its nose above its nostrils. And then it breathes it back in.
Mm-hmm.
And then it breathes it out again. And as it breathes in and out, the bubble inflates and deflates. And every breath it takes out, you know, a little more oxygen from the air. Air is about 21% oxygen, and you don't take all of the oxygen out of the air when you breathe in, just a small percentage of it. And so the weird part of this is they actually tested this, and they tested it by using an emollient. An emollient is like a lubricating agent, like skin lotion.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually rubbed it on the nose of the animals, which would not allow the bubble to form. And what they found is that the ones that had not been treated could stay underwater about 32% longer. So it looks like this is how it works.
They are very cute. If you go on to and Google scuba diving lizard, you'll see that they're kind of cute. I wonder, though, if they're underwater, do they become predators for the other folks in the sea?
That's a really good question. That's a really good question.
Because everyone loves chicken nuggets.
Yes. And apparently everybody loves water animals in the forest.
Joe Johnson, thank you so much for some of these great stories.
You're
of science
welcome.
That you
always,
bring us.
Always my pleasure.
And you're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Hispanic Heritage Month, and one unique piece of that heritage is Las Feliz, known also as the Spanish Alps, an area in Ulster County that became a popular destination for Spanish and Cuban vacationers. A new documentary, Back to Las Feliz, highlights the vibrant music and food scene at the resorts during the 1960s and 70s. It's screening Thursday in Kingston as part of the city's Hispanic Heritage Celebration. Patricia Roballo spoke with producer and director Jimmy Castro.
I used to actually live in the town where Las Villas were, in Plattekill, New York. I lived there during my high school years, a couple of years in high school. But I used to go to the Villas, frequent them a lot of weekends during the summers that I was there. But then after that, I moved. I used to live in Virginia. I moved back to New York back in 2013. I retired from the military in Virginia, moved back to New York, and one night in 2014, I was having dinner with a couple of friends of mine, and the wife of the friend, the names are Frank and Carla. I was having dinner with them. Carla, she used to be one of the owner's daughter. One of the most popular villas back in those days was called Sunny Acres. Mm. And she was the daughter of the original owner. And that's who I was having dinner with that night. And for some reason, we started a conversation about talking about Las Villas and how we remembered it. And, you know, in 2014, they weren't even existing anymore. But we started a conversation and talking about it, and one of us brought up, wouldn't it be nice to just do something to remember that time? And at that time, I was actually interested in filmmaking. I became interested in filmmaking. And so I said, man, I would love to do a short film, maybe a documentary about it. And that's how the idea came up. That's how the idea was born, with us just talking about it that night at dinner. And so that's what started. I started research. I didn't have any experience as a filmmaker. I studied. I did a lot of YouTube searching. I purchased some books on filmmaking. I started studying. And a year later, I decided to give it a shot. I try to raise funds because making a film is quite expensive. It's not cheap. So I wanted to raise some funds, see if I could raise some funds to produce the film, but I wasn't having any luck with that. What wound up happening is I used most of my money to produce the film. It came out of my pocket, most of it. I was able to raise a little bit of fund in a GoFundMe campaign, but that wasn't really that much. So a lot of it came out of my pocket. And it took actually about 2.5 years to complete the entire production.
Right. And like I said, La Villas is a place, like I said, Plattekill, with all these hotels, boutique hotels, showed up pop that was started and catered to the Hispanic Latinos that are coming up from the city. I mean, watching your documentary the other day, it was great to see that like busloads of folks were coming up from the city, from Washington Heights, from the Bronx, and all coming up to enjoy up here in the Catskills and the weather and feel at home listening to music. And one thing I discovered in the documentary was really the evolution of some of the music that we have here today, like salsa. In the documentary, at that time when things were popular in the 40s, like salsa wasn't around. And it makes claims to saying that music was being developed here in the Catskills.
Yeah. If you speak to a lot of artists that performed there, if you speak to them today, there was many legendary Latin music artists that used to perform there. A lot of them have passed away, but there's still some around. There's still some musicians around. In the documentary, I have musicians that actually talked about them performing in the Villas. And if you talk to them, it wasn't really... Nowadays, it's salsa. It's all about salsa.
Right.
But back in those days, it was quite a few decades, maybe 3 or 4 decades, that the popularity of the Villas was happening. And it wasn't about salsa. It was about mambo music. It was about merengue music. It was about cha-cha, stuff like that. But a lot of the artists that performed there became salsa artists. And that type of music actually started becoming popular. So, but again, this was a place that it was not only hotels, it was a bunch of venues, hotel, restaurants, dance halls, but it was so many venues in one isolated location. I mean, you could actually walk from Villa to Villa. That's how close they were in proximity. You know what I mean? So that's another part of the popularity. And you mentioned the buses. That was the biggest, you know, the biggest thing about that time and being in that town during the summer months, to see a small little town like that and so many buses coming in one weekend. You would see bus after bus, hundreds of buses literally coming into the town filled with people to spend the weekend or even just one day and with their families in the Villa. So it was a really unique place.
Yeah, actually, as we were talking, I'm looking at a roadside plaque on Facebook. I saw that they put a plaque up at one of the spots where La Villas was, one of the hotels or La Villas was located. And the plaque says La Villas' name was given at Plattekill and Catskill Resorts that offered Latin music, food, and culture, starting from around 1914 that folks were coming up here.
Actually one of the co-producers of the documentary. His name is Ish Martinez. He actually wrote a book also. I don't know if you know about the book. Las Villas of Plattekill, New York, and Ulster County, I think is the name of it. He's the one that spearheaded that to get that plaque up in Plattekill, which did eventually happen. And that's a nice marker there in the town. Yeah.
So these buildings, because where I live now in Sullivan Catskills, we're home to the Borscht Belt, which, you know, I always feel that La Villas is at this Hispanic Borscht Belt almost in a way.
Yeah.
And I have never heard of La Villas until recently. And even online, if you do some searching online, there are sites, you know, dedicated to a lot of La Villas, Facebook pages. But not a lot of history is known other than your documentary and some of the things you have seen, like maybe your friend's book, your other producer's book there. Some of the buildings that were these resorts, are they, some of them still around? Do you know, or what is the status of some of the buildings?
If you go into the town now, you won't even recognize any of the places that used to be Villas. Mm-hmm. There might be a couple of buildings that existed back then and were Villa, but only a few that I could think of. Most of the original buildings that made up La Villas aren't there anymore. They've either torn down or remodeled to apartment buildings or something like that. But there's only a handful, maybe two or three, that you can actually see the building that used to be there. Right. If you know anything about the Villas, if you used to frequent them, if you used to go there, you won't even recognize it today if you went into the town today. It just doesn't exist.
So take us back then. How many, in this height of his day, how many Villas were around?
I don't even know, man. There was a sign that used to be up that actually, when you drove into the town, it listed all the villas on that one sign.
Yeah.
And that one sign, if I remember correctly, maybe 15 names, 15 venues. But there was more than that, because it wasn't only in Plattekill, New York. Now, the majority of the popular villas were in Plattekill, New York, but there were also other villas in other little towns outside of Plattekill. You know what I mean? Modena or even Newburgh. But the majority of the popular villas were in Plattekill, New York. And I would say maybe at one time during the peak of the popularity, man, maybe about 20.
One of the websites I came onto, one of our fellow public radio station, WMC, did a podcast, I think last year, that talks about villas. They're claiming by the 50s, there were already 50 resorts in Plattekill area at that time.
Yeah, again, it could have been, could be, because again, it wasn't only in Plattekill. There was other scattered outside of, in other little towns scattered outside of Plattekill. But yeah, it could have been.
Now, you said you attended some of the villas when you were younger?
Yes, because I lived in Plattekill for a while.
Okay.
And so, I did.
And let's talk about some of the memories you have going to the villas.
Dancing. I was like a teenager in high school, junior, senior in high school. All I remember was dancing, man. Dancing with the beautiful Latina women that came up, especially the Puerto Rican women from New York City. I'm living in a little town in Newburgh, and all these beautiful women. And of course, there were also beautiful girls in living in Plattekill too. But my main thing was asking girls to dance, man. I was on the dance floor.
And also here from your documentary, which is food that looks delicious. A lot of authentic Puerto Rican food and Spanish food was being made up here in the restaurants that cater to
dancing. That was definitely the food, the dancing, the music, just the ambiance, the happiness. It was just a happy place, man. It was a fun place. It was a party place. It was a party town. And Latinos, man, we party. And a lot of those, the majority of people that came to the villas, believe it or not, were coming up from New York City, getting away from the hustle and bustle of New York City, the concrete jungle, getting up to the country and just partying, man, partying and having a great time. That's what it was all about. You know what I mean? When you talk to people nowadays, that's what they remember the most about, that party atmosphere, food, dancing, socializing. It was great. And not much crime either. People might talk about it. Yeah, we remember some fights or stuff like that. But as far as crime, man, it didn't exist, man, when we were all partying and having a good time in La Villas, man. It wasn't happening. No crime.
And these resorts were made out to make it look like places like they were in Spain or in Puerto Rico, in the back country. And just as me thinking, during those times when Puerto Ricans were coming into this country from Puerto Rico, my mom is Puerto Rican, so she came during the 50s, 60s to the Bronx, whole diaspora of factory workers coming here, because that's what she was. She was a factory worker.
Right.
And there weren't a lot of places that Puerto Ricans can go to and feel safe at that time. And would you say La Villas was a place that Puerto Ricans can go and other Hispanics can go and be there amongst their own people and feel safe?
Yeah, absolutely. Initially, I didn't do much of the research from the initial creation of La Villas, which was way back. I heard 1930s, 1940s.
Yeah.
That was when Spanish immigrants from Spain actually came up state New York and started building these establishments. That's where it was actually created, from Spanish immigrants. And then, you know, when it really became popular was when Puerto Rican families started coming up and buying these venues,
right,
buying them off. And at the peak, again, I talk about the peak, which was maybe 70s, 80s, 60s, 70s and 80s. The majority of the owners were Puerto Ricans. And they did. They wanted to get that feel of back home. Even Puerto Rican immigrants, a lot of Puerto Ricans from the island of Puerto Rico would move to New York City back in those days. But they missed Puerto Rico. Going to La Villas was like I said before, I did interviews before, and I would say Plattekill used to be called Little Puerto Rico.
Yeah, going back to the backcountry of Puerto Rico, and then you know, the way that the island looks in many places.
Yeah, and also that's the way the Spanish immigrants that initially created them thought also. They wanted to get that feel of their country, Spain. So yeah. They brought it to upstate New York.
This Thursday, you're going to be showing, the documentary is going to be showing at Hudson Valley Water Sports in on 483 yeah. Able Street, Kingston, New York. You're going to have a sort of a panel discussion, right? I see here on the flyer, you're going to have Ulster County Sheriff Juan Figueroa. You have a property manager, Ida Rodriguez, and a employment training person from the county, Ulster County, Alicia McDonald, are going to be joining you on this panel.
Yes, both of the events, the one in Kingston, like you said, the 26th, Thursday, and the one in Albany, which is Sunday, October 13th, they're both the documentary, Back to Las Villas documentary screening, and then followed by a panel discussion and Q&A. That's, both of them are going to be the same thing, where I'll be on the panel with them, and we'll be talking about it and taking questions and things like that. So they're both the same concept.
Right. Yeah. And I see the one here in Albany will be stuck. We shown at the Huxley Theater, New York State Museum. And this happened. That's on Madison Avenue in Albany, New York.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, can you say that address for the Kingston again?
Sure. Kingston is 438 Able Street, Kingston, New York.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And the show starts at 6 p.m. this Thursday in Kingston.
Yeah. So this will be, I always look forward to doing this. That's why I got into the project to begin with, to just keep that legacy alive, man, because it was such a unique legacy that I don't think will be duplicated, to be honest with you, in New York. I don't think it'll ever be duplicated, a place like that. It was such a rich legacy, man. And I wanted to keep that. Everybody that was involved in the project, with the documentary, with the book, that's what the intention was, man. Keep that legacy alive. And it was really something, if you've never experienced it, man, you missed something huge. It was amazing. And this is like my, man, I've screened the documentary so many times. The initial premiere screening was back in 2015.
Wow.
In Newburgh, New York, at the Ramada Inn. It was a sold-out event. That was the premiere of the documentary. And then the documentary was also picked up by two major film festivals. So, I didn't even think that would happen. The other thing I was really surprised about but proud of was my narrator that narrated that documentary. Anybody that loves Latin music should know who Tito Puente is.
Yes.
The king of Latin music. And his daughter is the one that's narrating. Audrey Puente is the narrator. She's surprised to this day, man, that I was able to get her to narrate that thing. And I was, right before I went into the production of the documentary, I was thinking about who was going to be the narrator, because I needed a narrator for a documentary. You need a narrator for any documentary.
Yeah.
And I was still, you know, I was getting ready to produce it. I had my plan. I had the script written and everything. But I still didn't have a narrator. And one day I'm sitting watching the news, man. Channel 5, New York, Channel 5, Fox News in New York City, right?
Yeah.
And Audrey Puente is the meteorologist, one of the meteorologists on that station.
Oh, wow.
And so she's doing the weather, man. I'm looking at her. I knew who Audrey Puente was. I knew her. I didn't know her personally, but I knew Audrey Puente was Tito Puente's daughter.
Yeah.
But I'm watching her say the weather, right? And I'm listening to her voice. And I said, man, wouldn't it be nice if I were to get somebody like her to do the narration? And I thought about it a couple of days. And I said, you know what? I'm going to just reach out to her. And I tried to find her number. I couldn't find a phone number, of course. But she was on Facebook and social media, and I sent her a message, and I am.
Yeah.
And man, within one day, she responded, man.
Oh, wow.
And she gave me her phone number to call her. I called her. It took me like 2 minutes on the phone to convince her, not to convince her, because she said she wanted to do it right away.
Yeah.
She said, yeah, my father used to perform there. I remember La Villas. I'll be glad to do it, Jimmy. And I was like so excited about that, man.
We're talking to Jimmy Castro, one of the producers, director of Back to Las Vegas, a documentary about this sets of resorts that were up here in Plattekill, New York, right above Newburgh. There's going to be a documentary we'll be showing again this Thursday in Kingston and again in October in Albany. Jimmy, thank you so much for talking to me about this and letting us know about this unique and special time in history.
No, muchas gracias, Patricio, man. Thank you for having me, man. I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Roballo for Radio Catskill.
And that's going to do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
WJFF Jeffersonville. You're listening to Radio Catskill.